Ladies and gentlemen, good evening once again. I'm Tamara Wittes, director of the Saban Center at Brookings, and on behalf of everyone at the center, let me add my welcome to all of you for joining us tonight. I'm happy to tell you that we are now on the record. So let me also welcome those who are watching the session live on our webcast. Although most of our Saban Forum sessions over the course of this weekend are off the record, for the rest of this evening and for our other on-the-record events, I want to encourage all of you watching here in the room and through the webcast to tweet about the event using the hashtag Saban13. This Saban Forum is one of the two major annual conferences that the Saban Center at Brookings produces every year. But every day, our scholars are producing the thoughtful, independent analysis and policy insights that inform our discussions this weekend. There are a lot of talented Saban Center scholars, hardworking staff, and a number of distinguished alumni in this room tonight. And as we celebrate our 10th anniversary forum, I'd like to take a moment to recognize all of them. Of course, none of their incredible work would be possible without Cheryl and Chaim. And I really want to thank you both. Now, the next part of our evening's program is a conversation between Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, and the Washington Post's David Ignatius. You all know David for his insightful column in the Post, where he pulls back the veil of what motivates Middle Eastern leaders and sometimes breaks some really interesting news. You probably also know that David writes spy thrillers that get made into movies and are more fun than anything else I could think of to take to the beach. But as a former professor myself, the thing that I love most about David is that he's a teacher and an explainer. He's someone who applies the age-old lessons of history and philosophy to the rough and tumble politics of the Middle East and helps us make sense of what we see. David, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And joining David in conversation is someone who has very quickly become an essential part of our U.S.-Israel dialogue, Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Minister Lieberman has been involved in political activism and Israeli politics almost from the moment that he and his family emigrated to Israel from Moldova in what was then the Soviet Union in 1978. In the 1980s, he helped found the Zionist Forum for Soviet Jewry. In the 1980s and 90s, he worked closely with Prime Minister Netanyahu in the Likud party. And in 1999, Minister Lieberman founded the Israel Beiteinu party, and he has served as Minister of National Infrastructure, Minister of Transport, Minister of Strategic Affairs, and as Chairman of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. This year, Minister Lieberman and Prime Minister Netanyahu combined forces, brought their parties into the elections in a joint list, and produced the anchor for Israel's governing coalition. Minister Lieberman, I understand that last year when you came to the forum, you gave my boss, Strob Talbot, a workout, making him practice his Russian. We are very glad to have you back with us, back in Washington and back at the Saban Forum. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman.
So, Foreign Minister Lieberman, this really is your welcome back to Washington event. You've been away from us for a year, and this can't have been the easiest year that you've spent. As the audience knows, in November, Foreign Minister Lieberman was acquitted on charges after an investigation that's lasted...
Not acquitted, I was reborn,
Well,
reborn from the beginning.
gone on for many years. So congratulations on having that behind you, and it's good to have you here in Washington. While you were away, a few things have happened. And I want to ask you to talk with us tonight about the things that have happened, because this has been a very momentous year. And I want to start with something that one couldn't have predicted a year ago, which is that Secretary of State John Kerry has led a very aggressive effort to restart a Palestinian-Israeli dialogue. And so I want to begin by asking you, this is an issue on which you have strong feelings. Secretary Kerry said today in Israel that he thought the possibility of peace was very close. You have been quoted in the past as saying you think it's decades away. And so let me start by asking you whether Secretary Kerry has convinced you that it's possible.
Thank you, David. First of all, I understand that I am a sweet dessert in the end of this meal. And I'm sorry about not to be so sweet. And by the way, I am not emigrated, I am repatriated. It's a really very, very serious difference. Regarding the, of course, the Palestinian issues, you know, we must understand why, after 20 years since we signed Oslo Accord, we're still in the deadlock. And I completely agree with many of your colleagues that I'm a very bad guy, and I told the last year also. But we really had very good guys that they believed that it's possible to achieve comprehensive solution. They took all the risks, like my friend Ehud Olmert in Annapolis. Before we had Ehud Barak as the prime minister in Camp David, and even Netanyahu in White Plantation, in the White Plantation. But despite all these efforts, and of course all the efforts of the American side, we're still in deadlock. Without understanding why we're in deadlock, it's impossible to move ahead. The other mistake that I think that I see, you know, we must start not from the, even not from security and not from, you know, refugees, but from some simple thing that I call, you know, trust. Trust, confidence, credibility, because today the trust between two sides, it's about zero. It's impossible, you know, to create peace if you don't have any credibility, if you don't believe to the other side. And maybe the other mistake from all our experience in the past, you know, up until today we signed agreements and treaties only with the rulers, not with the states, not with the people. Our Camp David agreement and with Jordan, it was our agreement with the rulers. And I think that we must achieve real comprehensive solution with the Palestinians, not with the rulers.
So let me ask you about one part of what Secretary Kerry has been trying to do. From what little has been reported, he's been pretty good at keeping secrets, but it is said that he's trying to work on security and American security guarantees that will reassure Israel as part of the process of thinking about borders for a Palestinian state. So I want to ask you whether there is anything the United States could do in terms of guarantees, offers, commitments that would give you more confidence as foreign minister that Israeli security was protected and that this process should go forward?
First of all, I think it's crucial, you know, to keep this dialogue. Because even if you're not able to resolve the conflict, It's very important, you know, to manage this conflict and to maintain these very, very fragile relations. And I really appreciate all efforts of the Secretary Kerry, you know, to keep this process alive. Because I really, to speak frankly, I don't believe that it's possible in the next year, this year, to achieve comprehensive solution, to achieve some breakthrough, but I think that it's crucial to keep our dialogue. Because, you know, it's we live in the same region, in the, same region, we're neighbors, and it's important at least, you know, to think about coexistence. And we appreciate all the efforts. And I think that today it's also, you know, not to create a lot of expectations. Because if you create expectations and you didn't succeed after expectations, you have disappointment, frustration, and after you have the violence. And I think that it's step by step. It's a long-term long-term process. It's not a short-term term.
I didn't hear any security guarantee the U.S. could offer that you would take as moving the ball forward. So I'll move on to...
No, but on security issues, to clarify my position, you know, I think that on all security issues, it's, you know, it's our responsibility. And in the end of the day, we must be able to protect ourselves and not to rely even on our best friends. I think, if I may, you know, in the United States, you have enough problems, enough headaches without Israel. And really today, United States, you are facing too many challenges. From China, Japan, South Korea, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, you have some domestic problems, budget, healthcare, etc. And I think that it's really, in the end of the day, we must understand your problems, not to bring only our problems to our table, you know, our shared table. And I think also when I spoke in Israel, again to clarify, our really strategic main partner is the United States, but not instead of United States, but in addition to United States, we must diversify our policy to adopt a creative policy. Because, you know, it's impossible on Monday, you know, on Monday we come with a request on Iran, and on Tuesday Palestinians, and on Thursday we had to write in the Security Council, and we come on Thursday with complaints on Europe. It's impossible. And we must understand where we can be helpful for the United States, what our contribution to this partnership.
I want to ask you in a moment about what other partners Israel might look for. But before we leave the Palestinian question, I want to ask you, Foreign Minister, let's say that you're right and that this process, there just isn't enough trust, it's going to break down, it's not as close as Secretary Kerry wishes. You've spoken often about your feeling that these populations must separate. And so I want to ask you, if there is a breakdown of the negotiations, would you think it appropriate for Israel to pursue unilateral measures to gain security and to achieve greater separation of population, and what comes from that?
I don't speak about separation of population, and of course I don't believe in unilateral steps. We have very good example with disengagement, and you know, when we see today what the results of this disengagement, and we sacrificed a lot. You know, for example, we speak about settlements as an obstacle to peace. As I spoke in previous meetings, that it's really misunderstanding, maybe misrepresentation, because we signed two peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan despite settlements, and in the case of disengagement, we evacuated 21 flourishing settlements, and the response was 16,000 missiles and shells on southern Israel. I don't believe in unilateral steps. And regarding, you know, what I spoke in the past, and I believe that it's maybe really right approach, not separation, but exchanging of land and population. Not separation, not transfer, but exchanging.
But for that you need a two-state solution, don't you? I mean, doesn't that idea make you, in theory, the strongest advocate of that solution?
You know, I declared publicly after the Bar-Ilan speech that it's acceptable for me. I accepted the Bar-Ilan speech and the vision of Bar-Ilan speech. And even before the elections in 2009, before elections, not after elections, I gave a long interview. And again, I explained that if I will be sure that it's possible to achieve comprehensive solution, stable peace, I will be ready to evacuate my own settlement and my own home. It's not a secret. It was published in all mass media. The problem is that today, to speak frankly again, I don't see any chance to achieve this comprehensive solution.
So let's turn to this very interesting, provocative comment that you made about Israel needing other partners to work with, not just the United States. So I want to ask you, one of the things that happened while you were away from the foreign ministry was that the United States and Russia began to work together on a plan to dismantle Syria's chemical weapons. Some people have worried that that means we're inviting Russia into the Middle East, that Russia will have new influence. And I want to ask you first, do you think that's happening? Second, do you think that's dangerous? And third, but this is really the heart of the question, could Russia be one of those other partners that Israel could work with in a way that would enhance Israeli security?
I'm sorry, but I must repeat again, we don't have any alternative to United States.
I don't mean any partners, diminution of your...
I think that it's crucial for us to understand what we can help to United States, not only to use United States, what we can bring to our shared table. And I think that we can bring something. We have some added value. And it's a mistake only, you know, to cry and to come to United States with requests. And what, from my point of view, the new directions, the creative diplomacy, it's completely different directions. It's, first of all, Africa and Southeast Asia. And we have what to bring to these regions. You know, if we speak about the food security, water management, I think that really we have a huge experience. And I'm happy to see that my colleague, I think, on the way to Africa after Washington, the Minister of Energy and Infrastructure. And it's very important for us.
Those are huge issues. But I do think this audience would be very interested in your assessment of whether Russia is going to be playing a larger role in the region and what effect that's going to have on Israel.
Russia, it's a completely different issue, and what we see that it's impossible to disregard Russia. They're still very important, maybe key player in many regions in the world, include Middle East. And what we see, Russia more Russians more and more active in Middle East, not only on the Syrian issues, but on other issues also, include Egypt. And of course, we have very close conversations with Russia. And I think that, you know, at least we keep the sincerity. We have enough disagreements, but we keep the sincerity and very open dialogue with Russians. It's also very important. And I think what we see in the Syrian case, when Russia and United States, they have common view, common approach, its implementation of this approach, it's really much, much easier than in all other
cases. And what is your sense as a careful observer of Russia tell you about what's possible, what's likely, when the Geneva Peace Conference on Syria meets at the end of January? Do you think Russia's prepared to work with the United States for a political transition in Syria or not?
I think that maybe, you know, it's clear that the biggest disagreement between Americans and Russians on Syrian case, it's a future destiny of Assad. And Russians, of course, they try to keep him in the game. And the others don't accept this approach. And I think that in any case, Syria, it's very, very complicated conflict. It's not, first of all, it's became real civil war within Syria. And it's a very mixed conflict. You know, first of all, it's the Shiite in Sunni. And the second, of course, the frictions between different religious and different people. It's Kurds and Christians and Druze and Alawite and the others. These ethnic clashes, it's really something very, very deep with a lot of atrocities. And of course, involvement of different regional powers like Saudi Arabia or Qatar or Turkey or Iran. And of course, the same the world powers, Russia and United States. And of course, terrorist operatives and organizations from all around the world. Jihad and Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. And today it's became something very, very complicated. It's not enough only the meeting in Geneva. And the same, it's real something that it take, in my assessment, it will take a lot of time. It's not enough only to achieve some agreement in Geneva.
So speaking of Saudi Arabia, there are people who say that beneath the public surface that one of the security partners for Israel going forward, in fact, de facto, may be King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. What do you think of that?
I think that real Saudi Arabia in a very delicate situation because the biggest threat from Iranians, it's not even to Israel. It's first of all to their allies, to the Gulf countries. We see what happens in Bahrain. And of course, the biggest concern of Saudi Arabia, it's first of all Gulf countries, and of course the Saudi Arabia kingdom. They're not so worried about Israel. And but the clear for Saudi Arabia, so that the biggest threat for them, it's not Zionism, not Jews, not Israel, but their radical movements in the Arab world, like Sunni radical movements like Al-Qaeda, and of course the Iranian ambitions. And also it's, you know, their decision, but we, you know, from our point of view, we're open for any dialogue with all countries.
Well, folks, you know, I thought I almost heard an endorsement of a de facto Israeli-Saudi understanding about security. Didn't quite hear that, but close. So I want to ask you about the final thing that occurred in the time that you were away from the foreign ministry, and that obviously was the negotiation that led to the interim agreement with Iran and the P5+1, leading toward negotiation of a final end state agreement. And rather than asking you to repeat the positions that your prime minister has taken, I want to ask you specifically as foreign minister what your own feeling is. Secretary Clinton made a very explicit appeal. It was off the record, so I'm not going to go into it, but the audience heard it. Are you comfortable with essentially the idea of negotiating the doable deal, not the maximalist deal that you might dream of having, but the deal that's doable? Are you, as foreign minister, going to be comfortable living with that?
First of all, and it's very important to emphasize, you know, it's impossible to conceal the disagreements between us and Americans on this deal, but it's unnecessary to discuss those disagreements publicly. And I think to cool down the atmosphere, it's also very crucial today. And of course, the second point, I can only to compare this deal with the Syrian deal. What was in the Syria case? On Syrian case, first of all, it was a decision to destroy all the infrastructure, all the capacity, all the means of production of chemical weapons, and the second, to take out of Syria all the chemical materials. In the Iranian case, the centrifuges that they were spinning before the agreement, they continue to spin today when we talk to each other. Even today, 9,500 centrifuges. And the second, of course, they keep all enriched uranium up until 5% within Iran, inside Iran, and they keep control on this enriched uranium. It's a really crucial and big difference between two deals. And of course, Iran, you know, what it's really something that unacceptable for me and for Israelis. Day before signing of this agreement in Geneva, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, before Revolutionary Guard, spoke about Jewish people as pigs and dogs, and Israel will disappear, and we will wipe the state of Israel. And I didn't see any protest of any political leader in Europe. Only Secretary Kerry, he made very strong expression about this unacceptable, you know, Nazi-style accusations against Israel and the Jews. And I think it's also something that we must pay attention. And we know what the Iranian intentions. We see their involvement in all terrorist activity all around the world, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and of course their nuclear ambitions. With all this, you know, ideology, with all this philosophy, it's something that bring all this world to very, very bad reality. And what we have today, and we can say today really openly, that we're in the beginning of the nuclear arms race. Today, what we have in Egypt and Turkey and Saudi Arabia, all of them, part of this nuclear arms race. And nuclear arms race started in the Middle East. And consequences, it's even more serious than horror movies in Hollywood.
So before I turn to the audience for your questions, I want to ask you one last question of my own. You said a moment ago that you think it's important to turn down the rhetoric in, if I understood you, in the U.S.-Israeli relationship and to be less publicly critical of the U.S. in this period of negotiation. And that made me think of a theme that's been in the Israeli press a lot since
your acquittal. Don't believe to Israeli press.
Well,
you can believe maybe to American press, but not to Israeli press. And all of the Israeli journalists are sitting before you.
I get to ask the man himself. I wanted to ask you was whether these reports I keep reading about a new Lieberman,
you know,
are true. I mean, I keep reading that you've become mellow and you're just a different. So let me ask you. You just said you want to turn down the rhetoric, turn down the heat. That sounds different. What should we expect that will be different in the way you conduct yourself as foreign minister going forward from what we know from when you were foreign minister before?
I think that you speak about Joe Lieberman before us, not about me. But, you know, I try, you know, to really not to be politically correct, but to say everything what I mean and what I understand. And in the past, you know, the prejudiced views and the biased approach to me in Israeli press, in our society, it was a part of my political life. It's not something new. But maybe today is the first time that I feel more, you know, people try to understand what happened. And I think today it's much easier to explain for me my position, my vision, and it's maybe more acceptable. I don't think that there is today some difference between Lieberman today and Lieberman in the past.
But why is it easier today for you to explain your positions?
I know, for many reasons, you know. I think, first of all, it's no doubt what happens in the court. It was very, very important. It was crucial. And maybe for some other reasons, but no doubt it was the main reason, because everybody in Israel was following and monitoring, and before the court decision, before they acquitted, and they acquitted completely, it really was a huge interest. And I think it's some turning point.
So let me turn to the audience now and ask you for your questions for Foreign Minister Lieberman. I may call on people if I don't see hands, so watch out.
It's dessert.
Yes, Chaim Savan.
Okay.
Minister, we spent a few minutes, but you made a statement here that I'm looking for a clarification on. You said that they're still spinning the centrifuges. That is correct. But at the same time, they have also committed, at the end of 6 months, not to have more enriched uranium than they have today. So that's the pause button. Is that a bad thing? The second question is, why do you get all excited about Khamenei calling us pigs and dogs? They've been calling us pigs and dogs since the days of Pharaoh. We're doing okay. So he's got his own constituency to deal with and appease his crazies on his side. I don't think that this means anything as to their intent. It just simply doesn't mean anything as to their intent. It has no substantive value. And we shouldn't be paying attention to this crazy guy when he calls us whatever he calls us.
This crazy guy, he really may be irrelevant, but you know what we have in our dialogues, Chaim, with the EU, especially with Europe, they are preaching it, teaching us what the democratic values and how it's important to keep the values. They speak a lot about democracy and to protect those values. And I think that my expectations not from Iranians leader, but from European leaders. And, you know, like up until today, Chaim, the Salman Rushdie continues to hide between London and Paris because they didn't cancel the death sentence against Salman Rushdie. And I don't see that in EU somebody really has a concern about this, death sentence against Salman Rushdie. And they executed in the last year about 600 people. And also we didn't see any protests. But when it comes to Israel, of course, everybody tries to teach us what to do and what is the democratic values. But regarding the first question, it's really unnecessary to discuss all the Iranian issue in mass media and publicly. In the end of the day, it's our responsibility of our government, and we will take all decisions in a very responsible way. And you know me, also my philosophy in my private life and my political life. If you won't shoot, don't talk. And it's in the end of the day, it's our responsibility for the future, for the destiny of our citizens.
I just wanted to ask you whether you don't think, Foreign Minister Lieberman, that you and Israel should speak to the Iranian people. I mean, the 50% of the Iranian people who elected Rouhani did so for a reason, which is that they want change. And if the answer is go away, is that the answer you want to give to the Iranian people?
No. With the Iranian people, we enjoyed really friendly relations with the Iranian people 100, maybe thousands of years. Only after the Khomeini revolution, we had what we have today. But in the past, the ties between Iranian people and Jewish people, really, it's a long history. And mostly it's really, we enjoyed very good relations. And of course, we have some dialogue with Iranian people through mass media, but it's not enough. And again, in the end of the day, security of the Israeli citizens, it's our responsibility. We hope for real change in Iran, because today also even the nuclear weapons, nuclear power, nuclear capabilities, not nuclear weapons, nuclear capabilities, it's first of all, it's question of responsibility. You know, there are many countries that they have nuclear capabilities, and for them to create nuclear bomb, it's only a political decision. For example, Germany or Japan, they have all knowledge, all infrastructure. For Germany or for Japan to create nuclear bomb, after political decision, it will take maybe six. Amos maybe know better than me. Amos Yadlin, maybe six, maybe 7 weeks. We not worry about Japan and we not worry about Germany. But we really worry about Iran, because the real center of power, it's not the new political leaders. It's not Rouhani, it's not Zarif, it's still Revolutionary Guard and Supreme Leader.
So let me, yes please, and then Dennis, and then there was a hand back here. Yes, sir. Yes, the microphone.
Foreign Minister Lieberman, I'm one of those journalists who wrote harshly about you. But as you were acquitted, and we're all dealing with serious matters, I'll first of all give you the compliment that you're a rational player. As a rational player in a position of great responsibility, realizing the great threat of Iran and the challenge of the Palestinian issue, don't you think that actually the rational move would be to adopt something like the Olmert plan or something resembling it? So, number one, because you do not believe there is a Palestinian partner, they'll be the one rejecting it rather than Israel. And number two, Israel will gain legitimacy for the real struggle against Iran.
Again, you know, it doesn't matter if I believe or I don't believe in the Palestinian partner. And I explained, forget about me. Since we signed Oslo Accords, it's more than 20 years. In September, it was 20 years. And the question why we didn't succeed. When I, in my first term as Minister of Foreign Affairs, I clarified my position from the beginning. I am not involved in this issue. I don't want to be an obstacle. I'm ready to give a chance. But after 4 years, and I was appointed in 2009, and I really made all my best to keep far from the Palestinian issue, even today, I don't see any progress. You know, and you must ask yourself, why? Why Mahmoud Abbas didn't sign in with Ehud Olmert this agreement with Condi Rice in Annapolis? And I think today also it's
So why not call his bluff? It's so simple. If this is the case, let Israel have the moral high ground by calling his bluff, winning the debate vis-a-vis the Palestinians, changing completely its positioning, and be in a much better position regarding Iran, where people do not listen to us right now because of ongoing occupation.
It's not our dialogue, but again, I think all our direction on Palestinian issue, it's wrong direction, and we must, at least to take a time out for some policy review. Why? To explain for ourselves why we in this deadlock or in the, at least we failure up until today. The second, Iranian issue. I don't like all the public discussion about Iranian issues. And I'm not ready to, to say something in addition to what I said. I think it's really serious decision, and serious decision, it's impossible, to discuss on TV screen or in mass or in interview. It's a long discussion. I'm not sure that all people here have all information and they able, to take decision without understand all the picture with all details. It's a complicated issue. It's not simple decision. It's not black and white. And at least, to be serious, it's you must take the decisions, not in public opinion, but really in some discussions in cabinet with people that they have all information and all, possibilities to take right assessments.
So let me turn to Dennis Ross, who had his hand up.
Thanks. A brief comment and then a question for you. On this issue, David, that you mentioned about a maximal position or a maximal deal versus a doable one, I suspect that the real distinction is not between a maximal position and a doable one. It's what's an acceptable outcome, what's an unacceptable outcome. Leaving Iran as a nuclear threshold state is not an acceptable outcome. Then the question becomes, how do you define what's a nuclear threshold state? But then the question for you, this issue, I think, of the convergence of interests with the Saudis leads me to a question. Would you be prepared, given this interesting sort of strategic convergence right now, would you be prepared to take a fresh look at the Saudi peace initiative, It's been out there for a long time, was adopted by the Arab League. Would you be prepared to take a new look at it?
You know better than me that it's completely unacceptable for main reason, the reason of refugees. The Saudi initiative included the issue of refugees. You know, to accept all the Palestinian refugees in Israel, it's to destroy Israel. And it's a key issue. The refugees and their readiness to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. I think without understanding these two issues, it's impossible really to sign an agreement to move forward. You know, we also had a lot of Jewish refugees from all Arab lands, and we absorbed them within Israel. We didn't keep them in the refugee camps in the artificial way. And by the way, I didn't see that somebody really cared about the Palestinians. In the biggest refugee camp near the Damascus, El Yarmouk, in the last month, were slaughtered 1,600 Palestinians. I didn't see any discussion in Security Council. Even I didn't see some protest from Mahmoud Abbas. And I think that it's also must be clear. And the biggest problem with, again, with the Saudi initiative, it's this special item about the refugees.
Just to follow up on
the right of refugees and the right of return.
Follow up on Dennis's question. Aren't you worried as foreign minister charged with Israel's relations with foreign countries about Israel being isolated? Isn't that a danger given the series of comments you've made about negotiations breaking down, not seeing an alternative? Isn't isolation a concern for you?
Of course, isolation it's not a splendid isolation. It's the biggest problem, but you know, also we understand what the picture in the international community. We one small Jewish state, and around us 57 Islamic states that under their control about 70% of all energy resources in the world. You know, I have some friend when he was in opposition, he was a right wing of Israel Beiteinu. Now, 2 years ago, he became a prime minister of one of European states, and he adopted all pro-Palestinian, you know, visions and stance and requests. And I was very surprised. I spoke with our mutual friend, and he explained me. You know, he head of state. He has a huge unemployment, economic problems. He looks for investments. All investments, they are coming from the Gulf countries and from Turkey. What do you expect? And I can understand. But despite all these problems and challenges, I think that we really must adopt different, you know, creative diplomacy. And there is a place for Israel in this modern world. And we must be more active, and there are different directions and different countries that we can bring for them something new that they need. First of all, the technology, the knowledge, agriculture, water resources, etc.
So there was, yes, question, yes, ma'am.
It's a little bit bizarre to address you in English, but since we don't have an opportunity,
you can ask in Yiddish. You can ask in Yiddish.
In Russian as well.
To answer in Yiddish also.
But someday in Israel in Hebrew, I hope so. Minister Lieberman, does Prime Minister Netanyahu share with you the details of the talks between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Kerry? And if so, what do you think about the statement that Kerry had stated today before he left Israel? Is full of hopes about the negotiation?
I really don't know. Maybe it was something dramatic, something new. I came from New York. I was last 3 days in New York. My feeling is that we have a lot of desire, but I'm not sure that it's possible. I'm not sure that we really so, you know, it's so easy to bridge these gaps, and it's we're so close to some kind of agreement, even interim agreement. I think it's something very, very deep, and we must start not from the borders and even not from security, but again, from the trust, from the credibility, and without trust and credibility, mission impossible.
But you didn't ask the first part of the question. Prime Minister Netanyahu shares with you the details of the talks?
No, on phone, of course, no. But
no, not today.
Of course.
On a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course.
So you are fully aware. You can be a good source.
I fully, you know, not fully. We speak at least 3-4 times every day.
At least.
And of course, I aware of all details, and my assessment, a different assessment, despite we are sharing the same information.
So you have disagreements with the Prime Minister?
It's not a secret, you know.
Is there anything you'd like to share with this audience about the negotiations? We're all very curious where this stands. You're unhappy with where it stands. So, do you have any more you want to tell us about it?
No, it's not a question unhappy. I think also, of course, all of Israelis, you know, all of us were looking for peace and for solutions and for stability. And as, of course, you know, we only one really vibrant democracy in all this region. Look around us. What happens in Syria? What happens in Libya? What happens in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Iraq? And I think it's also, you must appreciate and understand that it's not so easy to keep democracy, to keep prosperity in these very, very difficult conditions. And again, you know, to make a breakthrough, to achieve comprehensive solution with the Palestinians today, it's like, you know, to lay down the foundations of new house in the midst earthquake. Because Mahmoud Abbas really, he has very divided, he had of, you know, entity, not of Palestinian authority. He, of course, he not represented people of Gaza. And I'm not sure that he has majority even in Judea and Samaria. He postponed his elections, presidential elections, for more than 3 years. And it's really, you know, you can imagine in any democratic country that somebody postponed his presidential elections for 3 years. In Israel, despite all these, you know, problems in our region with the Palestinians, we still try to achieve peace and stability with all our neighbors. You know, it's misunderstanding that in Israel you have two camps. People that they are looking for peace, and the others that they are looking for war. All of us, we want peace and stability. We really have some disagreement what's the best way to achieve peace and stability.
So let me take a final question. Yes, please.
I have a question about, I don't know if you saw the gatekeepers, but five former heads of Shin Bet basically talked about how the occupation was corrupting the soul of the Israeli population. And my question is, do you agree that there's been an erosion of...
No, no, you know, I'm afraid to speak about five heads of Shabak. In Israel, it's not so
regardless, but
simple.
But, you know, there is a serious issue, and you said that you don't really want to talk about the Palestinian issue, although you have to a degree. Could you... It was
no,
a very
I speak about Palestinian issue, but I keep myself far from the Palestinian issue.
So, but do you think that the occupation is indeed really eroding the moral fiber of Israeli society? There have been several journalists who have talked about it. And since the instability in the Middle East has brought Al-Qaeda literally to the doorstep of Israel with Syria, them getting footholds in Syria and Iraq and all these other places, are you concerned that Abbas and the Palestinian Authority may seem like lambs compared to what you may have to deal with if they were to get into the West Bank?
Thank you. I completely disagree with you. And I think that maybe it's important to clarify the first point. I don't see any occupation. And to speak about occupation, it's not to understand the history of this region and the facts. You know, Palestinian Authority and Palestinian State didn't exist before 67. From 48 to 67, the Palestinian Authority, what we call today Palestinian Authority, was divided between two countries. It was under full Arab control. The Judea Samaria was part of Jordan, and Sinai Peninsula was part of Egypt. And I don't remember that from 48 to 67, they established any Palestinian state. And the same, the Fatah was established not after the 67, but before 67. And today to speak about the occupation, it's a misunderstanding of history of this region. I don't remember that Palestinian state was exist before 67, before 48, or even in the history. And we're really ready, you know, to share this small land. And all Israel today, it's 21,000 square kilometers. And we're ready to share with our neighbors and to sacrifice. I think only State of Israel made real steps, you know, to establish peace in this region. We gave up Sinai, we gave up Gaza Strip, we gave up half of Judea and Samaria. All the territory is six times more than Israel itself today. And I think that we proved our real desire to achieve peace. And to speak about occupation, it's really prejudiced, biased approach to this problem. It's not problem of territory. It's completely different problems. And I will never accept even this, you know, approach to speak about occupation and settlements, they're an obstacle to peace. No, the opposite is true, and we spoke before this. But the facts in history are completely different. Thank you.
So I want to thank anybody who spends an hour answering questions. I appreciate, and I know we all appreciate your being willing to take our questions. It's good to have you back in Washington, and we look forward to talking to
you. It's really good to be back in Washington in this capacity.